Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility, an ongoing inquiry into America's political origins and evolving institutions. The Executive Director of the Virtual Center is Dr. Bill O'Brien. He's also your host of this continuing conversation. Here he is now, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Agnes, and welcome to this Wednesday edition of the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Today is Wednesday. It is the ninth day of September in the year 2020. It is a pleasure to be with you once again today. I feel very good about the fact that I'm here 2 days in a row. After the last couple of weeks, I was beginning to wonder. And so I'm privileged to be here, and I want all of you to understand that I feel that way. I don't want to say that same thing over and over again too often. It sounds a little bit soupy after a while, but it's true. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's very real. I just don't want to, overdo it to the point that it seems not to be real, because it really is. So, anyhow, welcome, and I look forward to a couple of hours together looking at some very, very difficult issues. I think as we look back over the months and years, we could say we've been doing a lot of that. But you know, the issue of racism and this issue of white supremacy and right wing types infiltrating the police departments throughout the country is very, very, very disturbing. And you know, if you think about it, and I thought after yesterday's program, I went out and had a cup of coffee, and I was just kind of reflecting on the program, and while it was still fresh in my mind, and I thought about this issue of the white supremacist influence within police law and within law enforcement. And I thought, you know, there's a couple of things, and I'm just going to mention these, and then we'll do our intro stuff. But this is just stuff that I think is on my mind, and it probably should be out there. But for a long time, one of my nephews has been a policeman in his town in Massachusetts for a long time, since he was able to take the exams and qualify and all of that. And he's now moved up to the point where he's a lieutenant. I think that's the position he holds. But I mean, he's been very successful. He loves it. I mean, he does love it. But I had a conversation with him a few years ago on the whole issue of, you know, being a cop in today's world. And we were talking about that and the challenge, different kinds of challenges and stuff. And one of the things I mentioned to him, and he didn't get offended by it, but he was kind of surprised that I would say it. And I say, you know, when you watch TV programs, police programs on TV, detective programs, every once in a while, one of the characters in the program will make the argument or make the case, because it comes up in the story, that you can tell a policeman because somehow they all look the same. And I raised that issue to my nephew. And I said, most police officers, male police officers, you know, have crew cuts and that kind of thing. And the vast majority of them are white. That's one of the issues, of course. That's one of the major issues today. But they kind of walk and carry themselves in a way which almost identifies them. And I've always believed, and I told him that I did, I've always believed that wearing the uniform is in part at least responsible for that. Because there's something about wearing a uniform that makes you feel different. I'm not saying it makes you feel superior, but the reality is, for most people, different is superior. If you think about it. If the uniform made people feel inferior, obviously nobody would wear it. That nobody would want to be a police officer. So I kind of made the point, and then I told him, and I've mentioned this before on the air, because this is not a new issue with me, because I can remember mentioning this, although it was probably a couple of years ago, but I can remember it. It's been something that's kind of nagged at me for a long time, and I remember raising it on the air at least one time before. When I was in high school in the city of Boston, there was a requirement then that every high school male student was required to take military drill or something connected to that, like band or drum and bugle corps or color guard or something. You had to take something that required that you drill, that you respond to orders, and that you essentially learn to accept discipline and live with it and function with it. And so I can remember that when I was in grade 8, and this started in grade 9. So beginning in grade 9, everybody had to take military drill. It wasn't grade 9, it was grade 10. Because grade 9 is now high school, but it wasn't then. At that time, what we used to call junior high schools were grades 7, 8, and 9. And high school was 10, 11, and 12. In the last few several years, that's changed. And now middle school becomes grades 6, 7, and 8. And high school becomes 9, 10, 11, and 12. So if you look at most high schools in the country, and I know this is true around here, when a student enters the ninth grade, they enter the high school. But when I'm talking about years ago, it was grade 10. But when I was in grade 9, and I knew that the next year I was going to have to take some sort of drill, military drill, I opted for the drum and bugle corps. I always wanted to play a musical instrument. Turns out bugle is not an instrument. But I thought, well, this is really a good chance. They'll teach me how to play play a bugle. And I've always wanted to do that. And then I told myself something that I've never forgotten. And I said, besides, I can't wait to wear that uniform. Because the drum and bugle corps not only wears chinos, a chino uniform, but they wear spats. White spats, highly polished white spats. And I just thought that was sexy as hell. And I told my nephew this. And I said, do you think this really carries, there's more to this than I always thought? That I always thought it was me. But I'm wondering whether, in fact, it's something that is generally true. That there's something about wearing the uniform that gives people a sense of importance or value or something. I don't know what it is. But I can remember riding the subways in Boston, the subway trains and the buses and everything else, and getting on and off and changing from one car to the next and all of that in that uniform. And I used to love it. On days when we had military drill, which was a couple of times a week, that we had to wear our uniforms to school. And so I had to wear that uniform all day in school. It didn't have that much of an impact on me while I was in school, because I was in high school. Every kid in the school was wearing a uniform of one kind or another. But when I'd get on, when school was out and I'd get on the bus and then go and take the subway, take the train, and then the trolley, I took three forms of transportation to get home. It was about an hour each day. And I, something about wearing that uniform, I didn't mind it at all, because I had a feeling people would say, oh, he goes to Latin school, you know, and he, you know, and this kind of thing. And I kind of made me feel good. And I was a little bit arrogant, to be honest with you. And I asked my nephew whether, in fact, that might be a little bit more persuasive among more people than I thought it was. And he got a little bit offended by that, because it applied to him. But it turns out that for several years he was in a detective bureau, and he just wore plain clothes, you know, jackets and ties and sport jackets and suits and that kind of thing. But now that he's an officer, I think he's a lieutenant, he wears the uniform with the bars and all of that. And I mean, there's no question. It makes him look elegant, makes him look important, no question. I love it on him. But I also love him, so what can I tell you? But the fact of the matter is, you know, I think that's probably somewhat universally true. So back to the point. In talking about police and talking about the issue of white supremacy within law enforcement, it struck me when I was reflecting on the program yesterday that this is really a toxic issue when you think about it. Because the history tells us, we looked at this in the second hour yesterday, the history tells us that from the very beginning, the role of the police was focused principally on peoples of color. That's where the presumptions of the most crime existed. That's where most of the emphasis, where the police presence existed. And a self-fulfilling prophecy, of course, that turned out to be where much of the crime was. Now, we know that there is this thing called white-collar crime and all this that goes on in boardrooms and executive offices around the country. We know all of that, and we know that that's crime because they're dealing with much bigger stakes than the kind of crime I'm talking about, the street crime, if you will. But the fact of the matter is, if you are a police officer, then that means that you're going to be spending the bulk of your time interacting with people of color, African Americans, Hispanics, and other minority groups. And there have been a lot of studies done about different minority groups as to which ones are more inclined to commit crime and violence and all that. We won't get into that. But the fact of the matter is, that's where the bulk of your time is going to be spent. That's what your job is. And so the fact that we would be talking about racism and white supremacy within law enforcement, when law enforcement's principal responsibility is to interact with people of color, makes the whole situation explosive going in. Just the nature of the issue itself, just when you frame the issue that way, it becomes very, very clear that there's going to be trouble from the get-go. And if you don't think of the people you're interacting with on a day-to-day basis, the communities that you are policing, if you don't think of those people as equal to yourself, if you see them as inferior people, people who are naturally, innately inclined to commit crime and violence, and to look at you in your uniform with hate, perhaps, then you are going to go into a toxic situation a very fluid, a very electric situation. And you're going to be walking in there with the kind of bias that really makes you makes it impossible for you to do the job that needs to be done, if you think about it. And so the reality is, unfortunately, most of the interaction between police and people of color, at least most of the interaction we hear about, I want to believe that there's a lot of very positive interaction that we don't hear about because it's not news. But for the most part, the interaction we hear about is not good news. It's bad news. It's about trouble. It's about problems. It's about crime and violence and abuse and all of these other things that are what Richard Wolff calls baggage, just superfluous baggage to this, to collateral damage is the term I was thinking of for this whole issue. So before we even get into a little bit more in today's program on that issue, I think it's important to recognize the severity of the issue itself. And the situation itself tells us going in that this is going to be a tough experience, that the interactions are going to be tough and tense and probably not all that pleasant most of the time. Because the police are walking into situations where the people they're going to be interacting with already look askance at law enforcement. They don't trust it. They don't think it plays fair with them. They don't think the members of law enforcement respect them. And the fact of the matter is, as you begin to look at this data, you begin to realize that they're right. For the most part, they're right. And that makes the situation an incredibly difficult one to solve. I don't expect that we're going to solve it here in this program. But I do believe that the mere fact that it's so challenging and so important and ultimately so necessary that we do solve it makes it worthy for the devotion of time on a program like this. Because it's a subject that has got become a lot worse, a situation that has become a lot worse because people have been reluctant to talk about it. People have tried to pretend that it's not there. They've tried to sweep it under the rug. They've tried to ignore it. And what they're ignoring is a situation that in many cases they helped create because of the biases and the prejudices that they brought to the table going in. So in a sense, there's a note of responsibility associated with all of this. And that explains why so many people are so uncomfortable and are unwilling to talk about this. Because in a lot of cases, it's a situation that people aren't proud of. Because they know that in large part, they're responsible for whatever the difficulties are at that particular time. And so, of course, the major issue is, so how do you solve it? What do you need to do to solve it? Is this the kind of challenge where there's a way that we haven't quite figured out yet, but there's some magic bullet that's going to put us quickly on the route to solving this issue? Or is this one of those issues that can only be solved by one person at a time, one day at a time? I think the general consensus is that the second one of those options is the most likely to be the most valid one. I think most people believe that. And that's the reason that I think this problem becomes so challenging. Because in order to solve it, one day at a time, one person at a time, it has to begin with a change in the people involved. We have to change attitudes. We have to change the way people think. We have to change what they believe. We've got to get them to question things that they have taken as gospel their whole life. Things that they believed because they were handed down to them by people that they respected. People who were in positions to guide them. And as a youngster, your job was not to challenge what these people were telling you, but try to be what they wanted you to become. So barring some sort of a problem, you tended to believe and totally accept what they told you as truth. Now, we're facing a situation where the first step to recovery is to begin to challenge, to question things that we've never questioned in our lives. It's a big challenge. And it becomes a much bigger challenge when you realize that it's only going to be solved when individual people, one at a time, begin to change. That's one heck of a challenge. And I think that's the problem that we're all facing. So anyway, that's a very lengthy introduction to the problem that we began to deal with yesterday, and I'd like to spend additional time on today. We looked at a few quality statements from different people yesterday. I know we looked at the Wall Street Journal article by Eugene Robinson on the president, on the issue of race. I need to share with you in this, I don't have any notes or anything on this because I just read it 5 minutes before we went on the air. I was looking at the New York Times, and in the New York Times today, I came across a review of a new book by Woodward on the president, on the Trump administration, Bob Woodward. And of course, all of us will remember Woodward and Bernstein from Watergate, all the president's men. If you remember that, it's that Bob Woodward. Well, Bob Woodward has continued to write insightful books on leading public officials. And he's been able to do that because for one reason, for a lot of reasons. One is he's talented. He's skilled. He's a skilled journalist. But a more practical reason is because of his who he is. The fact that he's got contacts that other people don't have. Because he has an impeccable reputation, not only for the quality of work, but for the honesty of his work. And what's become clear as he's turned out book after book over the years is that public officials who won't talk to anybody else will sit down and talk to Bob Woodward and will share with him things that they don't share with anybody else. And in reading this particular account of this latest book by Bob Woodward, I don't even know if it's out yet. The title of it is Rage. But this particular account in the Times today reports that Bob Woodward, this year, between I think February and June, had 18, that number is important, 18 private lengthy sessions with President Trump. He had 18 substantial interactions with this president. And in it appears, President Trump shared with him a number of things that we didn't know about him, about his attitude towards the COVID epidemic, about his strategy of intentionally not telling the truth. One of the things I saw this morning, for example, in this particular review, was that Donald Trump told Woodward that from the very beginning, he knew from briefings that this coronavirus was going to be a huge challenge, probably the toughest challenge that he would face as president. And there's a quote in there from the book by Robert O'Brien, who was in the inner circle of the president's advisors. And Robert O'Brien made the comment at a meeting in the White House with the president on January 28th that this COVID virus we're hearing about from contacts in China is shaping up to be the worst pandemic crisis the world has faced since 1918. And warned the president that this was going to be a tough one. President Trump, according to Woodward, told him that he intentionally chose to downplay the severity of the pandemic from the very beginning in talks with the American people. Not because he didn't appreciate how dangerous it was, but because he did. That he was on a mission to downplay this in order to not frighten the American people any more than the pandemic was going to frighten them. And it was, he felt, very important for the people of this country to believe that he and his administration had a handle on this whole thing and that everything was going to be managed and there would be minimal danger to the people. It wasn't true because fact is, it's very obvious he's incapable of managing anything like this. But it seems, at least to Woodward, from what President Trump told him, that from the very beginning, President Trump set out to not tell the truth, the complete truth, to the American people on this particular issue. Also, there were some revealing quotes in the little piece that I read in the Times about President Trump's interactions with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. And one of the things that the president made clear to Bob Woodward is that he was flattered because Kim consistently referred to him as Your Excellency. And Donald Trump liked that and made it very clear to Bob Woodward that he liked that. And what becomes clear when you read a couple of Kim's quotes in this excerpt is that Kim knew how important it was to Donald Trump also. And he knew exactly what he was doing. He knew that this president was totally susceptible to flattery. And according to Bob Woodward, the interviews he had with the president indicated that that is quite true. Because the president admitted that he was flattered to be referred to by a foreign leader like Kim Jong-un as Your Excellency. So I found that very, very revealing. But I also found the president's decision to downplay the severity of the COVID to the American people throughout as being very interested. Because like a lot of people, I've been inclined to believe that the president wasn't handling the coronavirus because he couldn't. And that he was telling the American people this story about very positive outcomes and we didn't have anything to worry about from the COVID and his administration had it totally under control and everything else. I was inclined to go along with the idea that he was just whistling Dixie, thinking that the American people would believe anything. And according to what Woodward tells us in this upcoming book, this was a conscious strategy that the president had adopted. I don't know. I think probably what I am interested in is looking at the rest of the books, because the one thing that you can say about Bob Woodward's books is that they never are disappointing. They always contain things that others never seem to be able to get their hands on. Because he's privy to information and contacts with people that other people in Washington just don't have. So, anyhow, but I was reading that just before we came on the air today, and it's kind of fresh in my mind. And I wanted to share it with everybody while it was still there, because I thought that particular thing was relevant, especially since we're looking right now at the whole issue of white supremacy and the racial problem. And I will say, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on this because I don't think the excerpt that I read this morning goes into much detail on it either. But Woodward seemingly tried over and over again to get the president to acknowledge the pain that people of color in this country have been experiencing for so long. And he kept asking the president if the president felt any responsibility for the situation that minorities find themselves in this country. And the president's response, according to Woodward, was particularly revealing. Because President Trump said effectively in this piece that I read this morning, almost the same thing that we quoted on the program yesterday from Attorney General William Barr. When William Barr made the statement that anti-discrimination is baked into our system, our political system. And I can remember on yesterday's program, I spent time focusing on the idea of being baked in and the negative connotations that seemed to suggest on the part of Attorney General Barr. And I can remember saying yesterday that if Barr believed from a negative sense, in a negative sense, that anti-discrimination was baked into our system, then the implication of that is that people were being told things that maybe the people telling them knew weren't true. In other words, this was an example of mind control. That people were being told things were true. That at least from the perspective of William Barr might not be true. And I made the comment yesterday that if you take that to its full length, to as far as it'll go, then you begin to wonder if William Barr questions the truth of anti-discrimination, does that mean that he believes discrimination under certain circumstances anyway is okay? And if he does, that is a real shocker. In the excerpt by Bob Woodward in this morning's New York Times, he points out that Donald Trump reacted very sharply, very quickly, when Woodward asked him about whether he felt responsibility and a need to try to develop some empathy with Black Americans, principally Black Americans. And he said Trump reacted very quickly and said, no, absolutely not. And then he said something that made me think of William Barr. He said, Bob, listen to yourself. Listen how you've been drinking the Kool-Aid. Listen to yourself. Listen to the way that you've seemingly been drinking the Kool-Aid. In other words, you believe this crap about anti-discrimination. That is, by implication, and this is only implication, and this is just me talking, this is an unbelievable admission by Donald Trump. Because what the President of the United States is saying, and he says it very clearly, is that he feels no responsibility at all for the fact that significant numbers of citizens in this country, because of their color, have been and continue to be regularly discriminated against. And he feels no sense of responsibility for that at all. None. When you think about that, that's amazing. Absolutely amazing. So here we have in 2 days, I mean, they're not, yesterday and today. But as far as this program is concerned, it's yesterday and today. In two consecutive days, we've had both the President of the United States and the Attorney General of the United States on record as indicating that they question whether, in fact, discrimination on the basis of race is wrong at all. That's effectively what both of them have said, if you think about it. That's what they're saying. That they're not sure. That for those people who spout anti-discrimination truths, as Donald Trump said, they've been drinking the Kool-Aid. They're believing what they're told. And by implication, Donald Trump is saying, don't believe it. It ain't true. Well, if it's not true, then the next step is that discrimination is okay. It's legitimate. And if you take it one step beyond that, by implication, you're saying that discrimination is legitimate, presumably because the very people, because of by who they are, need to be discriminated against, should be discriminated against, can't help but be discriminated against. Whatever lead-in you want, what you are saying is race is the defining factor in this society to determine which people can legitimately suffer discrimination. Now, a lot of this is speculation. A lot of this is by implication this and by implication that. And if you say this, then the next logical thing is to say this. And then the next logical thing is to say that. So I know that there are some people out there saying, geez, he's taking us down this kind of trail of no return because he's trying to get us to go along with something that may not be true at all. And I am willing to acknowledge that I don't know for a fact whether all of this is true. But all I'm saying is that my skills of analysis, my education, leads me to believe that there's a darn good chance that it is true. And if there's even that chance, and the President of the United States turns down every opportunity to right a wrong if he thinks it's a wrong, and he doesn't take it, then by implication, he is admitting that he subscribes to it. And that's as far as you can go. But the reality is, it's pretty far. When you're talking about the President of the United States and the Attorney General of the United States, that's incredible. So the fact of the matter is then that this idea of white supremacy, right-wing militia groups infiltrating law enforcement around the country, is serious stuff. because it suggests that those being infiltrated, law enforcement itself, is open to and vulnerable to this kind of infiltration. In other words, the reason that white supremacists seek to infiltrate law enforcement is because they believe that in law enforcement they're going to be well received. They seemingly believe that it's quite likely that they're not going to get a lot of grief from law enforcement once their supremacist views become known within the law enforcement community. In other words, as racists, they see a natural home in law enforcement. And given the responsibilities of law enforcement in this country, which from the beginning have been focused on a concentration on peoples of color, minorities, this is a very, very dangerous situation. And it sure as heck doesn't bode well for resolving it anytime soon. This is exactly the wrong way to go. We talked a few minutes ago about the right way, about what has to happen in order to turn the corner and begin to really solve this issue of discrimination driven or based upon race. And the idea that it would happen one day at a time, one person at a time, and how difficult that would be. Well, it's not only going to be difficult, it's going to be impossible. The more that white supremacist thinking and forces are able to penetrate the forces of law enforcement. Because what that means is the very place we look to for solving the problems is liable to be ripe with people committed to initiating or fueling the problems, not solving them. And to the degree that all of this is true, the idea of unwarranted violence against blacks, police crime on black Americans, would seem to be a logical outcome given the scenario that we just painted. This is some deep stuff. This is heavy, as we used to say. This stuff, I can remember saying this in political science classes when I was reading philosophers like Immanuel Kant and some of those people that you know, I just read them and reread them and reread them, and they were so difficult for me. And I'd say this is heavy. I'd say to friends, this is heavy stuff. And it is. It's so important, given the values and the principles that this nation was founded upon, given the values and principles that this nation must continue to honor, in order to continue to work. This political system can't work unless the values in which it was rooted are continually respected and honored. And the ideas laid out in Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, and that certain people are not better than other people. Is something that this nation is founded upon. It's something that people who come here as immigrants from other nations, from other parts of the world, are blessed to believe. And let me explain what I mean by that. When these people come here, they have no doubt that what the principles and values that this country was founded upon, what they've read about, what they've heard about, what they come here to find, they have no doubt that these things are true. They believe that they're true. They know that they're true. They know that this is one of the few, if not the only place in the world where they can come here and have their freedom and respect for them as human beings, as people, will be rewarded, will be respected. They believe this. It brings them here, and in under some situations, very, very dangerous conditions to get here, and they get here because they believe it so strongly. And can you believe that there are people in this country who don't want them here? People who believe what this country stands for, believe in what this country stands for, more than the people who've been born and raised here believe it. These people not only ought to be here, we ought to welcome them. Because what these people believe are ultimately what we want all of our people to believe. And these are people who already believe it. Why in the name of heaven would we not want them here? Because they look different than us? Because they worship differently than we do? When you think about it from the big perspective, when you look at the big picture, it seems to me that you begin to put a lot of this stuff into perspective. And when you put the perspective together, it seems to be obvious, somewhat obvious at least to me, that we've gone down some dead-end roads in this country. We've gone off half-cocked believing things and looking for things. And the things we most want and need to find oftentimes are right under our noses. And we don't know it. And I think the people who willfully come here, sometimes at the risk of their own lives, sometimes at the risk of never again seeing family members. But despite it all, they struggle to make it here because they know that to them, this place is nirvana. This is the place that every human being deserves to be. In a place where they are respected, in a place where they are valued, in a place which they are not discriminated against, in a place where they're not looked down upon. When they believe that it's here, that's why they come here. How responsible we should feel when we condone behavior and we condone situations which violate those values and those principles. We are the ones that maybe shouldn't be here. We are the ones, maybe, who ought to be asked to leave. Because not abiding by the values and the principles on which this country is based is to threaten the nature of our democratic republic itself. This is how important this is. And I'm kind of thinking, and we're getting right towards the top of the hour here. It's about three minutes left before we take our break. But I'm getting to thinking that there are probably people who've listened to the programs and heard yesterday's program especially, who are thinking, you know, I thought this was a program on the Constitution of the United States. I tune in thinking I'm going to learn about the Constitution. And I'm getting all of this other stuff. And the fact of the matter is, this other stuff is what the Constitution of the United States is all about. And what the Declaration of Independence is all about. And whether, in fact, we know, because historians have told us, that many of the principles that these people signed off on and wrote about in speeches were things that they themselves didn't live up to, didn't subscribe to. And that, therefore, maybe that means that these values and principles and ideals really aren't all that important anyway. I think we need to rethink that. I really think we really need to rethink that. Because they are extremely important. Our nature, our system, political and economic system, require that we subscribe to them or it can't work. And given the nature of the changes, the demographic changes that are happening in the world and happening here in this country, we have got to begin to recognize the value of all people, irrespective of the color of their skin or the color of their eyes or their hair or anything else. We have got to. Because the luxury of being the majority and calling the shots, which white Americans have always had in this country, is rapidly disappearing. This will be my last comment before we take our break. I was reading in one story this morning about, and we may get into it actually, is about the Electoral College. And it was a specific reference to the state of Texas. And the fact that in the state of Texas, Donald Trump received 4.5 million votes in 2016 from the state of Texas alone. And Texas is a Republican state for now. But this particular article was saying that Texas is moving towards becoming a blue state. It may not be in 2020. It may not even be in 2024. But eventually, there are going to be more Democratic votes coming from the state of Texas than Republican votes. And when that happens, the 4.5 million votes that Donald Trump received in 2016 will effectively be erased. They won't even count anymore. And the Democrats will be the ones taking the taking advantage of the Electoral College. And so the argument is, it seems to me, that the nature of this country is changing, and we better begin to change with it, because it's changing whether we want it to or not, whether Donald Trump wants it to or not. So with that, we're right at the top of the hour. It's 1 minute after the top of the hour. So we're going to pause and take our short break, 5 minute break. You're listening to the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. We're going to take 4 or 5 minutes and give everybody a chance to get up and walk around, loosen up and stretch a bit. And then we'll begin our second hour. I hope that you'll stay with us. Thank you. Thank you.
return to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Here's your host, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Agnes, and welcome to this, our second hour, on this Wednesday edition of the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Today is the 9th day of September in the year 2020. It is a Wednesday, as I mentioned. It's the last hour that we will have. It's not quite an hour. We'll have a little bit short of that this week. And then we'll plan to be back together again the first of next week. And I'm very optimistic that when indeed I'll do everything I can to fulfill that responsibility, I promise you. And for those of you who stayed with us through the break and have been with us since the beginning of today's program, I really do thank you for staying. This is a tough subject. It's interesting because I was just thinking during the break. By the way, I got to tell you that music was astounding. I told Annette just before we came back in a chat that I was had everything I could do to keep from closing my eyes listening to that music, but I was afraid to do it because we'd never get back for the second hour. But anyway, it was wonderful. It's a tough subject. And I was thinking during the break that when I was teaching college classes, I would sometimes make mention of in the morning at breakfast before I went to class, I'd mention to my wife what I was going to talk about that day. And of course, it was most of the time I was teaching courses in American history, and especially the survey course, which was taught to freshmen, sophomores. They were large classes by definition, and they were younger people, freshmen and sophomores in college. And I would be teaching U.S. history, and I'd be covering things like slavery and the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s and all of these other things. And occasionally I'd mention to my wife, you know, what I was going to be talking about in class that day. And she'd more often than not say, God, you better be careful. Please be careful. Think what you go before you go in there. Think what you're going to be talking about and who you're going to be talking about with. And be careful because you can get in a lot of trouble, you know, it's a